convening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, Tuesday, February 12th. We have an informational meeting. Mr. Easton.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So yes, today what we have for you is an informational meeting prepared by the Oregon Society of CPAs. So this is a bit of an annual tradition at this point for the revenue committees. But the committees do get an updated information from the CPAs related to tax law changes in the most recent, a lot of times in the most recent tax year, but the recent tax law changes, focusing on the federal level and how those sort of filter through and impact here in Oregon, and then also some recommendations from the CPAs as well on how to take those into account. So we do have one document in the meeting materials from the society, so you can reference that. And with that, I would allow them to introduce themselves.
Good. Yes, please, please come to the table. We're looking forward to this.
Good morning, Chair Representative Nathanson, Vice Chair Finley, Vice Chair Marsh, and those members of the House Revenue Committee. For the record, I'm Heather Jackson, a member of the Oregon Society of CPAs Accountants Tax Committee. I'm a certified public accountant in public practice in Portland, Oregon, and appreciate the opportunity to be here today. On behalf of over 4,400 members of the OSCPA, I respectfully testify related to the Reconnect and federal legislative analysis that we have before you today.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Gary Holcomb. I'm a certified public accountant practicing in public accounting in Portland, and thank you for having us here today.
This year, the book is a little thicker than some years, so don't worry, we're not going to bore you going over every single page of this book. The book has mostly covered the 27 Tax Act and the amendments. The amendments that have happened since the act was enacted in 2017 are in red. So anything that's in red is newer and more up to date. Our committee has attempted to break down the federal tax law into five recommendations, similar to the prior years, A through E. As a reminder, our primary objective is to be a technical resource to the legislature and a secondary to promote taxpayer compliance by striving to keep Oregon tax law tied to the IRS code. Oregon's permanently connected only applies to the definition of taxable income. Oregon has been permanently connected to the federal tax since January 1st of 2011. We support rolling Reconnect, whether the tax implications to the taxpayer is increased or decreased. One exemption to this connection is that related to the pass-through income under RIC 199A, like the domestic production activities deduction in the prior year. So we already disconnected on one item. One exemption does not have a large impact to the taxpayer compliance, but many exemptions or differences to the connection dates may have a big impact to taxpayer compliance and subsequently cost the Oregon to issue lots of notices and or perform audits. These are some of the other issues that we also have to do with tax filing.
So I think, as in prior years, as Heather mentioned.
Excuse me, would you start with your name, please, for the record?
I'm sorry.
We just need to get it in the recording.
Oh, I didn't say it when I, good morning, Gary Holcomb, excuse me. Thank you. The recommendations key is, it doesn't have a page number, but it's similar to what it was on previous years. It's on the next page of the presentation. But category A, which there's a number of, are items that Oregon would automatically reconnect to under the current law provision. And there's a number of those without, unless you guys decided to proactively change something. Category B are items that are significant again in number, but they're things that Oregon wouldn't necessarily connect to, you know, penalty provisions, interest provisions, credit provisions that Oregon already isn't connected to. So you would need to proactively change to adopt or to conform to those provisions. But there's a number of those. C's are items that were federal changes that we would recommend to make Oregon connect. As Heather mentioned, to make Oregon connect, we'll go through the items as C. This year, there were no items D. And then items E were things that may be referenced in the tax code, but really don't have an impact in Oregon. And we'll talk a little bit about those, but things like excise tax that Oregon wouldn't have, but the federal has. So some of those are mentioned there. I'd like to give you a couple of examples maybe of why the Oregon Society of CPAs recommends a full reconnect in all cases. And really, there's many, and I'll just give two examples. But an example right now is the federal Congress is considering an extender's bill as we speak. And there'll be a number of provisions, assuming that that goes through, that are in that extender's bill. So let's just assume that that extender's bill gets passed, May 15th and signed into law May 15th. Typically, that bill then would be effective for tax year 2019. Correct. So then if Oregon is connected, then everybody in Oregon knows, okay, that's a federal provision, will be connected for our tax year 2019. I can make appropriate decisions based on that law. If Oregon is disconnected from that provision, it may be favorable or unfavorable to taxpayers. It doesn't matter which way it is. If they won't know what Oregon's going to do if we're disconnected until you guys meet in session again sometime in 2020 and then enact the provision in 2020. And can you then make it retroactive in 2020 all the way back to the beginning of 2019? When the taxpayers already made their decisions about 2019 taxes. So that's an example of one reason that we support Reconnect, is to help that certainty with taxpayers making decisions. A second example may be just like an administrative burden that a number of taxpayers would go through. And this is talked about every year, would be something like bonus depreciation or automatic expensing, right? So if we're reconnected with 100 assets in your business, you know what your depreciation basis is for gain purposes for that year's deductions. You automatically know what that is for Oregon and federal purposes. If Oregon disconnects and goes to some other type of system, then you have to track that not only this year, but all the foregoing years and when you sell and dispose of that. And it's not just those 100 assets, because you're disposing of 100, you may dispose of 10 of them, add 10 new ones, and you're having basis and depreciation differences across all those significant assets. So that means if every state was similar to Oregon and disconnected, you'd have the federal set of books, you'd have your financial set of books, and you'd have 50 state set of books to try to deal with. And I think for most taxpayers, I think all taxpayers, we could say that it would probably not be able to administratively keep track of that many sets of books. So those are several examples of reasons that we recommend reconnected to these provisions.
All righty. Any questions so far? Wonderful. Let's move on to the recommendations A. Biggest thing we're going to do is we're going to cover the recommendations in A and C this year. Recommendation A is a very thick section. We will be skipping items that we feel are less important or critical for us to cover today. It doesn't mean that they're not important. If you want us to cover one of them, please stop us and let us know. Recommendations B and E we will not cover in detail. We'll give you some highlights of it in a few sentences, but we're not going to cover every single item for those sections. With that said, on page one of recommendation A, let's see here, we are talking about cash method of accounting for inventories, and then on page two, UNICAP. All of these things have been affected. They have gone from a $1 million roughly gross revenue to all the way up to now it's $25 million before a person has to become an accrual taxpayer. So some people are switching from accrual to cash. These are just very high-level business changes affecting more taxpayers getting to do the cash method of accounting and not having to track as much inventory of those three items.
On page four was the next one that we thought we'd highlight, and that's the local lobbying expenses. What Congress decided to do in 2017 was to disallow lobbying expenses for taxpayers for state and local lobbying efforts. So that's no longer a deduction allowed at the federal level.
On to page 11,
Is that me again? Mm-hmm. All right, sorry. So we'll flip to 11. And again, if there are other ones, there's just so much in here, I think you guys would.
Oh, wait, I forgot page 7. No, my bad. I'd flip right past it. Page 7 through 12 cover, for the most part, depreciation. This is the 100% expensing. This is the limitation on luxury automobiles. This is the Section 179. Basically, the 100% deduction or 100% expensing has been available since September 27th of 17, and it continues to go for several more years. The Section 179 and luxury limits have just increased, so no major changes with those items. The last,
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this really is my favorite presentation. Thank you both for being here. And I'm actually going to go back very quickly to the very first page in that cash method of accounting. Just, and this is just to get a little insight from you. That seems like a really significant expansion of the allowance of cash accounting. And I just wondered if you could, if you have a theory about what the policy idea or what the accounting idea was behind expanding that, because that's a really significant change.
Opinion is that it was to make it easier for taxpayers. Cash method accounting is the easiest. There's no AP, there's no AR, there's no inventory. It's the simplest set of books. Basically, it's a check register, which allows expensing in sometimes faster and then income later, but that isn't always the case. Sometimes people get the revenue before they pay the expenses. So
I think that the changing from the 5 to the 25 was partly, I think, just time. I think it was 85. I think that's what it was. So it's just between 85 and 2017. And a lot more taxpayers would fit within that category that are technically small businesses, smaller businesses.
And would the idea be like service, in like the expansion of maybe service businesses where that is an easier, that makes more sense for them, and with the expansion of the service sector?
Service sector. In our economy. Also the people getting into manufacturing, so people new to manufacturing, just the cost of, you know, trying to be compliant when you're, you know, starting up and having to get to accrual basis quickly.
Great. Thank you.
And you had gotten about to page 11, is that right?
Yes.
I have a question on page 9. At the bottom of page 9, recovery period for farming property. Could you speak to that just for a minute? What's behind that and what the effect of that provision will be?
So what it is for farming machinery and equipment, you've always used 150 declining balance, which is a slower method of depreciation for farming equipment, and it was 7-year life. That's the rule we've lived under. This rule changes it to 5-year, and you can use double declining balance, which is the regular depreciation everyone gets to use for regular businesses.
So you end up expensing it faster.
Okay, thank you.
So on page 11, after all the depreciation and expensing provisions, is the limitation on business interest expense deduction, which is a major change. Any borrowings now that happen, the deduction is limited to your business interest income and 30% of adjusted taxable income. So if your interest expense was basically driving you into a net operating loss, there's going to be a limitation on that to how big of a deduction you'll be able to have on your business interest. The next one we'll highlight is page 14. And there's a number of changes within this, but this is entertainment and business, entertainment and meals expenses, basically. And the biggest change within this area is that true entertainment expenses are no longer deductible. So meals provided as part of entertainment can be deductible, but they have to be separately stated. If you bundle your meals and your entertainment together, then everything's not deductible. So you'd only have to have it if it's separately stated. And then there's certain levels of employee meals that are provided for the convenience of the employer that may no longer be deductible or deductible only at 50%.
Response to some high profile news stories?
Yes.
Sure. Okay. On to page 19. One of the ones that I've gotten many questions on, so we are bringing it up here, is deductibility of fines, penalties for federal income tax purposes. So basically what these have always been non-deductible for the IRS and for Oregon. They are now under very, very narrow circumstances allowing the deductibility of those. These are not, it didn't open the door for any, like some major whole bunch of deductions. It's very not fine number of people that would be able to use this deductibility. So it's limited practical use, even though I know a lot of people are like, yes, we get to deduct a whole bunch of things. That's not a true statement. So just wanted to make sure you understood that.
The next one is on page 20. And on the bottom of page 20 is qualified opportunity zones. Qualified opportunity zones, typically we said, you know, we would put credits in a separate category, as I mentioned in recommendation B, but the qualified opportunity zones actually impact income and determination of income. And what a qualified opportunity zone, local jurisdictions around the country were able to designate certain zones, and it's around 400 zones that have been designated in various states. And what can happen then is once a zone is established, a fund will be set up within that zone for investments. And if you have qualified capital gains from any type of investment, you can invest in that opportunity zone fund. And a number of things then can happen where your capital gains aren't immediately recognized, or you can then, they're deferred for either 5 or 7 years, depending on how long you hold the investment, or there can be a permanent deferral of that gain if the investment is held more than 10 years.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm next. All right, this gets a little complicated, so it's going to be hard to follow on the slides, but page 30 to 31, and then I'll flip to 37 also, so there will be a little...
Since you're skipping so far, I have a question about something at the bottom of page 21. Uh-huh. Okay. S-corp conversion to C-corp. How often does that happen?
I don't see it all that often.
From my experience, it's harder with the lower differential or the higher differential between corporate tax rates and individual tax rates now. There may be more reason to do that when the corporation rate, obviously at 21% versus a higher individual rate, there can be reasons why people would elect to do that. Before, when they were kind of consistent with each other, you wouldn't get that much benefit from doing it.
Any other questions before we move to page 30?
All right, so I did. So this is 30, 31, and 37, and these provisions are something we discussed, partially what we discussed last year, and these are the GILTI and FDII deductions for international provisions, basically. Under FDII, which is foreign deductible intangible income, that is another deduction that corporations are allowed because they brought on we've switched from a worldwide system to a territorial system. So now they're bringing all their income back into the U.S. So they're allowed a deduction for certain types of intangible income that has been taxed in another jurisdiction. So it's a deduction. The corresponding or the corollary to the FDII is the GILTI inclusion. So if you have global intangible low taxed income, so global income has been taxed at a lower rate than the U.S. rate, and it's from an intangible, you know, a trademark that's U.S. trademark that's used overseas or a patent technology that's used overseas, that income then that it comes back that is associated with that intangible, if it's been low taxed at like a 0% rate in Ireland, then it would be subject to this GILTI inclusion. So because you're bringing back income that can be high taxed and low taxed, it's trying to equalize it. So sometimes you're going to have an inclusion in your income, and sometimes you're going to have a deduction in your income, depending on how it's been taxed for foreign purposes.
I'd like to pause for a moment there. I want to be sensitive to your role here, which is to explain to us what's going on with the tax code.
Correct.
And if you're not in a position where you would care to comment, just let me know. But could you comment from an economic perspective what the effect of that or what the policy rationale is behind trying to achieve this equilibrium rather than some other outcome that might have been achieved?
I started by saying that it went from a worldwide system to a territorial system. So that's to equalize us with across around how most countries across the world will do taxation. So within that, you're taxed on what's brought back and the value that's done in the U.S. There's a lot less ability to defer income as it was in the previous side. So before you would defer that income and keep it offshore, do your activities offshore, unless you needed the cash was the only time you were ever taxed when it was brought back into the United States. And now that's just not the case because it's this territorial. So you have this low taxed income that they're saying, okay, that's not fair to not tax that. So when you'll have a guilty inclusion, but then sometimes you'll have this foreign, you're paying higher taxes and paying tax on certain types of intangible income. So therefore you're allowed a deduction. So it's one method of equalizing the taxes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would you say that the effect that happened with that change is that more money is flowing to the U.S. and people aren't parking their money in Ireland or overseas and investing it in the U.S.? Is that a correct interpretation of what's supposed to happen or what the intended effect was supposed to be?
Yeah. I can't really answer if that's what has happened.
Yeah,
but
right.
Yes, that was the intended effect.
Okay.
There's less incentive now. You've lowered the rates, so the U.S. is competitive. There's less reason to keep that cash overseas.
Okay.
And you have to think about it in two ways, right? There's income you've earned that you need to keep overseas because you're going to be expanding your operations overseas. So you're not always just keeping income offshore to have it not taxed by the U.S. You have legitimate business reasons to expand your operations around the world.
Thank you.
So that's guilty and fitty. I think, yeah, unless there's other questions, we'll move on.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about pages 45 to 50. This is the Schedule A itemized deductions. Let's see here. Let's get to you. So we're just going to go in order that they kind of go here. The Schedule A miscellaneous itemized deduction 2% floor.
Excuse me. I'm going to ask you to pause, please. I forgot. I have a question about something on page 36.
Oh, okay.
Could you talk a little bit about interest expense apportionment? When I read that, it really piqued my interest. Under the asset method, taxpayers are permitted to use either tax basis or fair market value of their assets. Could you talk a little more about this provision, not only what it does in a technical sense, but what's behind this?
Yeah, Heather, I apologize. I'm not that familiar with this provision.
Let's see here. Which one I'm trying to figure out. Oh. I'm not extremely familiar with this one.
It's okay.
We could look it up and get back to
it's okay.
If you'd like.
Apologize.
Yeah, we can visit about it later. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions? On to page 45, the miscellaneous itemized 2% floor. This is the section that we take tax prep fees, investment fees, the employee expenses not paid by the employer are all in this section that are now gone for a little while. They're suspended. So that is a major change to itemized deductions. You guys are at this point tied to that. The limitation itemized deduction, the next one down, is the PEAS limitation. This is if your AGI was so high, they limited your itemized deductions just based on that. That is now gone. Also suspended. The next one on page 46 is the mortgage interest deduction. This is changed for mortgages entered into after 12/15/17. The limit is now $750,000 to be able to deduct the interest. It was $1 million. There is a grandfather provision that all the loans prior to that date still get the $1 million limit for interest deduction. The deduction is not limited to your primary residence. I know that was talked about quite a bit, but you can still take it on second homes.
Before you get further down that list, I have another question.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit about what it means to be suspended? Is that, is it written this way because there is a legal distinction that's important, or is it a political type of decision? And if something is suspended, can it be unsuspended? Like 2 years later, can it change to something else? Wait, why was it done this way?
So the majority of the 2017 Tax Act is a 10-year provision. That's what it took to get it passed due to balancing budgets and stuff at the IRS level. So when they say suspended, that means it's the 10-year. Most of the time, the 10 years, when the law ends, we revert back to what we had in 2017. So that's what the word suspended means. It's just on hold, per se, until the act ends, which in this case is 2026. So that's the word suspended. If it says permanent, that means they've actually physically changed the law, like the corporate tax rate is 21%. That was a permanent change.
So until the next change.
Yeah. That was my last sentence. Is pretty much everything is as it is, but anything can change at any time. I mean, they can undo any of this. It's just the act itself sunsets, or a lot of the provisions sunset in the 10-year, at the 10-year mark.
This is very similar to how the previous tax cut at the federal level happened under the Bush administration. When that tax cut happened, it was also a 10-year provision. You know, and basically, as Heather mentioned, it was a budgetary, because you have to project the long-term deficit mm-hmm. from that. So you'll see there's still provisions, as I mentioned earlier, that Congress is considering the tax extenders bill. There will be provisions that would have otherwise expired that are trying to be extended right now.
Thank you.
On to page 46 with the state and local tax deduction. This one has made a lot of news, and this is the $10,000 limit to your real estate taxes and Oregon income taxes. Then when it comes over to your Oregon form, you guys have a new Schedule A form that's Oregon only. Obviously, the state income taxes isn't even on the form, which is great because it's not a deduction for Oregon, but the real estate taxes make it over there. That's the biggest thing with that one. This one we're calling out because we thought it might be of some interest to you, elimination of living expense deduction for members of Congress. This, as of December 22nd of 17, has been eliminated, the living expenses while you're away from your home or your districts. So thought we would mention that one.
Congress?
Oh.
Not now.
I was, but not anymore.
Absolutely.
Charitable contributions. contributions, which is the next one on 47. The cash contributions, in the prior years, you were limited to 50% of your HEI. So if you had contributions larger than that, they were carried forward on a carry forward basis. The limit now is 60% of AGI, so you get a little bit more of your charitable deductions. If you had carryovers coming into the 2018 tax year, you can use those as well, but you still are maxed at the 60% of AGI, so a little bit more charitable deductions. The 80% deduction, if you gave to certain universities athletic funds and they would say on the bottom of the thing, 80% is a charitable donation, that's now zero. They're saying if you're giving to universities to get preferential seat treatment or whatever, the athletic fund especially, there is no deduction available at this time. And again, these are all suspended rules. Questions on to page 48. The reason I brought this one up is this is the personal casualty loss, which is a separate item on below miscellaneous items, below the miscellaneous itemized deductions. Now you only get it if it's in a federally declared disaster area. So if it's federally declared, you can take the deduction. It just goes on Schedule A, whereas before it didn't have to be federally declared.
Representative Smith Warner.
About my shipwreck.
Yeah. Yes.
Because look, before my shipwreck would have been allowable. And now, unless it's a federal disaster, it's not going to be allowable.
Yes.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
You're welcome. Page 49, medical expense deduction.
I'd like to stop you since we stopped on that point. What was the reason for that change? Do you know?
To be honest, I believe it was abuse. Basically, you did have some rules to be able to deduct it, but losses and personal losses, I think, was an abused area of the itemized deductions.
I don't know.
Well, I think overall you'll see the theme, and I'll mention it when we talk about B. Most of these reconnect items that are in determining taxable income were revenue raisers in order to offset the tax cuts that happened. So,
yeah, Representative.
Yes. I might mention, thank you, Madam Chair, that all of the onion sheds collapse, all the agriculture buildings collapse, was not a federally declared disaster. That was devastating in Eastern Oregon.
I'm becoming very concerned about this. Yeah. We had the snow. Related events. We've had wildfire related events that have been disastrous in Oregon.
This is why we brought it up.
Thank you, Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Well, I'm just wondering on that note if we can ask staff to get some number. I mean, this is this is something we want to look at in terms of how we treat property loss within the state income tax system. So we could figure out kind of what the dollar amount that this would mean to us if we stay connected here.
Yeah, I'm just seeing head nods. We're making notes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
And reminder, this is personal casualty loss. It's not business casualty loss. So depends on what you had going on when you had the loss.
Yeah.
So. On to medical expense deduction on page 49.
Representative Reschke also.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So when you say it's personal, not business, could you define business? Is that also escorts and LLCs and LLPs, or are you just talking corporations? Because a lot of that income passes through, so.
Corps, the C Corps, the partnership,
so you can take it over
LLC.
There. Before, okay, thank you.
Yes, so it's more of the personal residences that had, the snow and the ice, the wildfires, all of that stuff where it's your personal house.
Personal.
This is what this is going to.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. The medical expense deduction, In prior years, it was 10% of AGI before you got a penny of your medical expenses, with some exceptions. Now it is it's back to the 7.5% of AGI, and you get your medical expenses. So that's their change. The medical expenses. And then the other piece to it is if you get your medical expenses, it's no longer subject to the alternative minimum tax. It used to be if you got your medical expenses, it went over onto AMT form, and you may have just lost the benefit of those actual deductions. So that is actually gone also. The itemized deductions section, if there's any other things.
I think we're gonna cover both of these. Alimony?
Yeah, we're gonna keep going. Anything on itemized before I move on to other items? Wonderful. The alimony payments, for divorce decrees, separation agreements, or modifications entered into after 2018, the alimony payments are no longer deductible and no longer income to the person receiving the money. So that's a change starting in 2019. For all the older decrees and divorces, they still get to deduct it and pick it up as income, as they have in the past. The last one on page 49, beginning of 50, moving expenses. As of 12/31/17, moving expenses are no longer deductible except for active military. There are some exceptions if your move happened in 17, but your employer reimbursed you in 18. That's still not taxable income to you because the move physically happened in 17. So there was that carve out for that.
But that's for that limited time period, not ongoing.
Right.
Most of those provisions were just that 10-year.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I ask a question about this miscellaneous itemized deductions? I'm a little, that continues to kind of stick in my craw as we go through this. I would like to point out that on page 49, you call it out again separately as tax preparation services deduction, but then I realized that you call it out specifically in a bunch of other places too. I thought maybe that was just a little extra emphasis that you guys were giving to it. I'm not sure who to ask you for this or LRO, but I'm just struck by what level of income taxpayer is that really going to affect? I mean, it feels like there is a sense, you know, there's stories in the news on social media about people being struck by their refunds going down, by their taxes going up, and it feels like this is one of those places where it's impacting middle income, lower to middle income people, and for a bunch of things that I would, yet there are other places in here where, like that, you no longer have the limit on high income people for their, I mean, they can continue to deduct, and with any limits taken away, but this ability to do these kind of taxpayer prep and other stuff just is eliminated entirely. Is there any way to get a sense of who uses, what level of income payer is being impacted by that?
It's also industries. So if you look at the mortgage industry, you look at nurses, doctors, where they have to pay their own licenses, their own continuing education, mm-hmm. their own whatever, because their employer doesn't pay for it or reimburse for it. Right. They just lost all their deductibility of those. So it isn't necessarily always about high income or low income people. These are actually industries that got hit, complete industries. And there hasn't, at least in my client base, I haven't seen a lot of change of the employer to actually pay for those expenses. So those people just lost their deductibility of those items.
Yeah, I don't think we can answer the question of who it impacts, but I think we can say it's a very broad impact. We're seeing it across a large number of clients. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
The other thing I would say is, without this deduction, less people will be in alternative minimum tax, because if you got this deduction, sometimes that threw you on top of the Oregon income taxes that you were deducting, threw you in alternative minimum tax. So people who were in alternative minimum tax in prior years probably may not be this coming year.
Thank you.
So I think that's the end of our Section A, unless there's anything that people want to go back and cover again. Okay.
So like we said, we're not going to go through our recommendation Bs. It just, if you flip to the first page, 55, it'll give you some good examples of what that is. So corporate tax alternative minimum rates, the corporate tax rates, the next page is a credit for certain clinical trials. These things, again, are federal tax policy that the ReConnect doesn't tie to in Oregon, wouldn't otherwise be impacted directly in their code by these items. So, is it fair to move on, Chair Nathanson?
Yes, thank you. So we're going to move on to recommendations, section C. It starts on page 80 of the handout. All right.
And there's just a few of these.
Yeah. on pages 80 to 83, this one is long just because of what it is. This is the pass-through tax treatment, which is the 199A deduction. At the very bottom of this on page 83, just a note that Oregon has disconnected from this in Senate Bill 1528. So we are disconnected. I wasn't going to talk a ton about it. I would answer any questions, but I figured we're disconnected and wasn't going to spend a lot of time. We just want to call out that you guys are disconnected at this point.
Thank you.
Okay. The next topic then will be on page 84. And again, this relates to the international tax reform provisions. You will see on the far right, the IRC sections, you'll see 245 cap A. And the cap A is material when you think about what this is. So what it allows for is some of that income that is being brought back into the U.S., not through a FDII, it's not FDII guilty, it's just regular dividends that are paid out by corporate, by foreign corps to their U.S. corporate parents. There's now 100% deduction for those. So very similar to Oregon has provisions like that now. If they're intercompany, usually it's 100%. A lot of Oregon provisions are 80%. So what was called the old subpart F income, Oregon allowed an 80% deduction for that type of income that was brought back. That old subpart F income is what's called 245 little a income. So there's some confusion on whether the 245 cap A dividend income that is being brought back into Oregon is also included within those the definitions of deductible dividends for Oregon. So we bring that to your attention as something to examine on whether that should be included within that definition. So that's, yeah.
That's a pretty dense thing that you just presented. I mean, dense, filled, it's packed with, yes. You have to understand every word of every phrase,
correct,
and every sentence to get it. Mr. Easton, we may need to go through that again when it comes up. Thank you. So prepare yourself.
The next provision is very similar, but this is one that you did deal with in last session. So this is the 965, 967 repatriation dividends that came back in 2017. So we pointed out here because we're trying to be encompassing the whole act. Mm-hmm. So you did make changes, and you know, I don't know if conformity is the right word, but you made policy decisions on how you were going to treat those types of income last year. So there shouldn't be any need to do anything, but wanted to make sure it was brought up as a major change. I think that's, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you.
Any questions before we move on to page 87, consolidation of education savings rules? This is the 529 debate that went on last year. So the whole IRS came in and said you get to take up to $10,000 and use it through K-12 private public schools. It's not limited to secondary education, college. Oregon has followed the rule with the caveat that if you take the distribution and use it for K-12 schools, that income, if you took the deduction on the Oregon return, is taxable.
So you guys have addressed it, but we wanted to make sure you at least knew it was here. And it was one of the things that we were talking about last year. Any questions on that? Okay. Just as a reminder, Section D has nothing in it, so we'll move along to Section E. Starting on page 88 to the end of the book, these acts may reference the tax code, but do not impact the tax code. Most of the items are excise tax on various items like aircraft, tax-exempt organizations and universities, beer, wine, sparkling wine, and distilled spirits. I just hit everything on all those pages in that time. It's excise tax on a lot of items. So any questions?
And we heard some news this morning about maybe a change in store on one of those.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So thank you for your time. Are there any other questions on anything we didn't cover, did cover through this presentation?
Other questions? Yes. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm about to completely offend all CPAs in Oregon, and I apologize. 100%, I apologize. I would share with this committee, if anyone wants a very simple, interactive exercise on how federal tax law implicates businesses, go buy TurboTax and run an artificial scenario through there. It takes you on an interview step by step of what's allowed and what is not. And in no way will you get the detailed information that we've been presented or that a CPA can provide to you. And so I'd never recommend you not talk to your CPA. But if you want a simple exercise of what's allowable and what's not, TurboTax for Business is a great way to just run an artificial scenario through. I'm sorry for offending any CPAs out there.
Any discussion? Any other questions? Yeah, Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a logistics question here. It says at the top of Section E that areas are indicated with an asterisk that may warrant further consideration. Where are the asterisks? I'm just not seeing
any in this section.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
This year there weren't.
There weren't any.
Okay, well, that simplifies things.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say this is very helpful. It's ironic because the last 3 days I've been on the phone with my wife going through my CPA's tax preparer statements. This answers a lot of questions on why isn't there any line on there for CPA tax preparation expenses and of several others. So, yeah, this has been very helpful. Thank you. And more frustrating.
I really appreciate your being here with us today. And it's also good to know that as something might come up at a future meeting, that you're there for us to call on. I know that you can, you would probably be willing to be available to write us a short memo or something if we have a detailed question on one of these provisions.
Absolutely.
I had a comment.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Well, and reflecting on Rep. Finley's comments and the fact that we're going to be going down, we've heard news reports about withholding and issues that are, I think it'd be interesting after this tax season, if there are lessons learned that would be informative for us to hear back from you, because you're going to discover what the real implications of a lot of this is in real life basis. So perhaps we could have them come back.
I have one more question.
Yes.
Thank you. I've met with my CPA and other CPAs in Eastern Oregon a few times before coming to this session. And I asked them the question of what would be the most impactful changes that we could make that would help most of our taxpayers to the tax code. So I would ask you to think about that question and get back to me. And we'll put you on the spot right now.
Since there might be another informational meeting coming up in the future, not this particular one, which is traditional, but in a, not to substitute for that, but in addition to that.
He said estate tax.
Yes, Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You need to do that.
So just to add on to what Representative Marsh said is lessons learned, but I would like to learn lessons at the federal level and also at the state level, because I think while we can't change federal law, we can learn some things, and then we can find out whether we've helped out at the state level or what we could do to help tax preparation at the state level and predictability. So.
I don't see any additional questions or comments. Thank you again for being here with us today. Anything else, Mr. Easton? We're adjourned.